From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Mitt Romney takes it by a nose in Iowa, Santorum right behind, Newt Gingrich not happy, and plans for a leaner American military. Just 8 votes back of Romney in the Iowa caucus, Rick Santorum had 2 words for his new fans.
Game on!
In New Hampshire, Newt Gingrich is hitting back against frontrunner Romney after being slammed by Romney's Super PAC attack ads in Iowa.
He'll do fairly well here. This is one of his 3 best states. But the fact is that Governor Romney, in the end, has a very limited appeal in a conservative party.
And Defense Secretary Leon Panetta made cutting back sound like getting better at the Pentagon.
Its great strength will be that it will be more agile, more flexible, ready to deploy quickly, innovative, and technologically advanced.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Howard Fineman of the Huffington Post, Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What do you see? What are we learning in the scramble of the GOP? And are you on board for a leaner U.S. military? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Manchester, New Hampshire, where the Republican primary spotlight has turned, is Howard Fineman, editorial director of the AOL Huffington Post Media Group, analyst for NBC, MSNBC, author of the 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. Howard Fineman, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you for that long and thorough introduction.
With us from
embarrassing, but I appreciate it.
It's all there. It's all there. With us from Washington, Kimberly Strassel, columnist and editorial board member at the Wall Street Journal. Kim Strassel, it's great to have you back as well. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, in the belly of the beast, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Howard, and Kim.
Kim, let me come first to you. You're on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. You know all things conservative. What do we see emerging this week and in the days ahead in the GOP? What's happening here?
You know, we see a lot what has happened up until now. We see Romney with not a lot in between him and the nomination unless one of these candidates can manage to go into the one spot where there is still an opening, which is to unite a conservative coalition to Mr. Romney's right. And Rick Santorum came out of Iowa, the latest guy with a bit of momentum, and we're going to see if that's what he can do, not necessarily in New Hampshire, which is very much Mr. Romney's stomping grounds, but if he can begin, if Mr. Santorum or Mr. Gingrich or Mr. Perry can begin to lay the groundwork to mount some sort of credible one-on-one challenge against him in the future.
Howard, what do you think? Not much at this point already between Mitt Romney and the nomination, even with his 8-point squeaker out of Iowa and, you know, everything arrayed around and against him?
Well, it's a paradox, because if he does take it, as Kimberly says, he'll take it sort of by default and because of the division among conservatives. Mitt Romney has about a 25-point ceiling on him, it seems, nationally, and certainly that was the case in Iowa. He'll probably do better than that here in New Hampshire, but he practically lives in New Hampshire. And I think South Carolina is going to tell the tale here. South Carolina, sort of the wheelhouse of the Southern Republican Party, if you will, the place where it was founded historically, in a sense, after the war by Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats, et cetera, the modern Southern-based Republican Party, that's South Carolina. If Mitt Romney can win in South Carolina, then it's over for sure. But South Carolina is the place where somebody else has to knock him off. Now, right now, in the provisional polls, Newt Gingrich is still ahead in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So if Rick Santorum wants to make a serious play, he's got to finish second here. He's got to finish a strong second somehow. Right now, up in New Hampshire, Ron Paul is still in second place.
Jack, here we go. Rick Perry barely made a showing in Iowa, went home to Texas to think about whether or not to continue, and then announces that he will stay in the race in South Carolina. Do you think Mitt Romney sent him a nice fruit basket or something? I mean, doesn't that split the vote and help Mitt Romney maybe come out on top even there?
It sure does. And Perry spent $480 a vote in Iowa as opposed to Rick Santorum's $21. And I guess he's got deep Texas pockets and feels he can match that in South Carolina. But yes, every single dollar he spends and vote he gets helps Mitt Romney.
Kim, what about Newt Gingrich's argument? He says, yes, of course. And of course, he's spitting mad after that spanking he took from Romney's super PACs in Iowa. A lot of attack ads there, and we'll see more of that, everybody says. But he says, look, he'll win New Hampshire, but eventually he or one of the other more conservative rivals, says Newt, will emerge to beat Romney. Do you see a path to that? that a possibility, Kim?
Look, all of these guys are playing for the long game. And what Howard said is right, is that this is not going to happen in New Hampshire. It's going to happen first, if it happens at all, in South Carolina and then in Florida. And what these guys are all banking in is that they stay in long enough, they make a compelling enough argument, other people begin to drop out the way that Michelle Bachmann did this week. You then get their votes. You outweigh the rest of the field that are all competing against Romney, and you begin to coalesce that support so that you can have a one-on-one race against him. Now, the question for all of these guys, I mean, Perry aside, he has a lot of money and the ability to wait this out, is do they have the infrastructure, do they have the funds to keep going if they don't do well in New Hampshire and they don't do a good showing in South Carolina? And so, you know, I think what we are going to see out of South Carolina is maybe one, two do well, the other one have to start making some hard choices and get out, then you may have more of a one-on-one race. That's the only path to mounting a challenge to Romney at this point.
Jack, you were out at a Gingrich event in New Hampshire, I guess just yesterday. I want to ask you about that, but let's hear from Newt just a little bit. Here he is talking pretty harshly about Mitt Romney and the role of the Super PAC ads that savaged Gingrich in Iowa. This is an interview with Nora O'Donnell on CBS's The Early Show. This was Tuesday.
I have to ask you, are you calling Mitt Romney a liar?
Yes.
You're calling Mitt Romney a liar?
Well, you seem shocked by it. Yes. I mean, what else could you say?
Why are you saying he's a liar?
Because this is a man whose staff created the PAC. His millionaire friends fund the PAC. He pretends he has nothing to do with the PAC. It's baloney. He's not telling the American people the truth.
Is he a liar? And then, Jack, that sort of soft, petulant stiletto. Yes. what did you see with Gingrich on the stump in New Hampshire? What's the tone?
Well, he spoke at the Littleton Opera House in Littleton.
Way up north.
Yes, and got a good reception from the audience. He did. He dismissed Romney with really the damning phrase, a Massachusetts moderate. Well, at least it was a moderate. It wasn't a liberal. But he said that more as the way you'd say pederast, Massachusetts moderate. But mostly he directed his fire at President Obama. And I maybe not be a fair judge of this, but they did seem to be, even by standards of political rhetoric, cheap shots. For example, he made much of President Obama's saying to the Brazilians, we want to buy your oil, when he was down there on his trip, I think, a year or so ago. And he said, what kind of a president would want to buy Brazilian oil? Adam Smith, Wall Street Journal editorial page, free market, isn't that the whole idea? We buy oil where we can get it. And, of course, the president's point about Brazil was it looks like a stable country to buy oil in as opposed to the Middle East. He went on about the food stamp president. He said, I'm not going to be the food stamp president. I'm going to be the Obama is. I'm going to be the paycheck president. But of course, you know, food stamps, as David Gregory said to him on the Meet the Press a few months ago, isn't there a little racism in here when you connect this with African Americans, as he went on to do?
Especially when many more whites are
many
in that
more
lineup.
Whites, seniors, and children are the main recipients. And of course, food stamps are tied directly to the downturn in the economy. And finally, he contradicted, without seeming to notice it, the basic premise of Republican economics. He said, look, we had great job growth under Reagan, great job growth under me, meaning himself, and Bill Clinton, and look what we have now. Well, of course, back then we had higher taxes on the rich in both cases. And Republicans argue, you do that, it kills jobs. Didn't do it in those two cases.
Well, so he's got his complaints about Obama. He's got his complaints about Romney. Arizona Senator, former presidential candidate, former New Hampshire winner John McCain stood up for Romney on Wednesday. Here's him with his kind of endorsement line on CBS's The Early Show.
I agree with him on almost every issue, and so I'm proud to endorse him and support him and get this thing done with as quickly as possible and get into the main event.
Howard, was it inevitable that McCain does it? Is this the Republican way? Or you know, it still comes back to this question. Do we somehow still have a thing that rolls forward sloppy?
Well, John McCain tore into Mitt Romney up, down, and sideways 4 years ago, and he's endorsing him now, but that's the way politics is. And the fact is that the infrastructure of the McCain campaign from 4 years ago, which was built on the infrastructure of the Bush campaign 8 years before that and the HW campaign before that. This is a whole generation of of operatives, Republican establishment operatives in New Hampshire. And Jack knows all the names, I'm sure, and I know some of them. They're all behind Romney, so they were going to get McCain to support him. But it wasn't that thrilling and overwhelming and enthusiastic an endorsement.
Kim, you called Mitt Romney Mr. Good Enough. Now, that may be good enough to win the primary. Is it good enough to, you know, is it? And is it good enough to win against Barack Obama?
Well, I think what Romney has done here is a sort of divide and conquer strategy, and it's worked very well for him. I mean, he's been fortunate to some degree in that, again, the opening against Mr. Romney is to his right and a candidate who can unite conservatives who aren't necessarily happy with Mr. Romney. They're not happy with some of his social positions. They're not happy with what they see as a sort of timid tax policy. They're not happy with some of his flip-flops in the past. And so the question, and could you ever get someone like that? A lot of the people who might have had a shot at doing that, Governor Chris Christie did not decide to get into the race, so he had benefited from that. A lot of his rivals have made giant mistakes, and they've got out of the race. Guys like Tim Pawlenty, if he stayed in, he might have been able to do that sort of uniting. But Mr. Romney himself has been very clever about kneecapping, you know, his opponents who pose that biggest challenge. You saw it doing with Mr. Gingrich and these super PAC ads, which really did go after him, and you saw it with Rick Perry before that, touching on one of the few things that he had a real weakness with conservative voters on, which was immigration policy, and Mr. Romney really got after him on that. And so he has, as a result, kept anyone from unifying the base, kept them as emerging as a one-on-one opponent, and this has been his benefit. So he could, yes, well, march on without any sort of giant enthusiastic support.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a dead heat out of Iowa, new Pentagon strategy, game on in New Hampshire for the GOP. Kimberly Strassel is with us, editorial board member at the Wall Street Journal, columnist there. Howard Feinman's with us from AOL Huffington Post Media Group, author of the 13 American Arguments. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go up north, just across the border from New Hampshire. Harry in Chester, Vermont. Hi, Harry. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
All right. What do you see?
Well, what I see is this. I first of all, I go hunting and shooting over in New Hampshire with a bunch of guys over there who have hit a number of ranges because they're competitive shooters.
Uh-oh.
This guy Romney moved in two years ago. He's not a regular guy. His hair is too short. He's stiff as a board. No real man wants to vote for this guy. If anything,
tell it like you see it, Harry.
He's a real dud.
A dud. Oh, well, you know, okay, Kim, let me bring this to you. Dana Milbank in a column today, you know, he's kind of got Harry's line. I don't think Dana's out there hunting with Harry, but...
No, I doubt it very much.
I doubt it. But he says, look, you know, McCain grudgingly gives this endorsement, but actually, he says behind the scenes, it feels to him like Romney's barely holding together the momentum of his campaign. It's awkward interactions, stumbling campaign stops, so you're out of touch with the people. You know, is there something still just really not clicking despite the formal advantageous position it seemed to be in?
Look, this is the Mr. Good Enough point, which is that, I mean, this guy has run a smooth, I mean, for the most part, there has been some stumbling campaign stuff, but he's ran a very slick operation. He's got lots of money, lots of ground troops. He's out there. The problem with Mr. Romney is people up until recently just have not felt as though he is the leader for these times, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that Republicans don't like this current president and they'd like to see him leave the White House. They're very worried about the direction of the country, and so they want someone not just that can be President Obama, who's going to be a big new bold leader for the conservative movement. And they don't necessarily see that in Mr. Romney. Mr. Romney, for his part, what he has been doing like the Energizer Bunny from the beginning of this race is repeating the same things over and over, which is that I am a guy who can fix the economy, I'm competent, and I am the person who is best chosen, best placed to beat Barack Obama. And as voters are being asked to finally decide, some of them are saying, well, that might have to be good enough this year. And I think that you saw that in his victory in Iowa, and that's going to continue to be his message going forward.
Howard, what about his core argument? I want to listen to just a little bit of it here. We're hearing it very regularly now, where he goes after Barack Obama for European-style social welfare state inclinations, trying to draw a bright line. Here he is. This was in his speech the night of the Iowa caucuses, Mitt Romney, out going after the president.
The president has a different view. Instead of seeing a merit society, an opportunity society. I think he takes his inspiration from the social welfare states of Europe. He wants to make us an entitlement society, where government takes from some to give to others. The only people who do well in that setting are the people in the government who do the taking from one to give to the others.
Okay, Howard, give us some real assessment of this. I mean, we're hearing it again and again from Mitt Romney. I'm trying to figure this out. Barack Obama as a European social welfare state builder, really? Is there merit in that argument?
Well, let's back up a little bit. First of all, if you're in New Hampshire and you're a conservative Republican, you're listening to this and you're saying, you got to be kidding me. Mitt Romney was the get-along, go-along, tax-raising governor of the Socialist Republic of Massachusetts. In other words, what Mitt Romney's done here is he's adopted the argument of all the other conservative Republicans. One of the, and Kimberly's right, he's run a very slick campaign, and one of the slick things he's done is absorb the best and of the memes of and the themes of the other candidates. Yeah. One thing that all the Republican candidates agree on is that they hate Europe. Okay, they can agree on that. They don't like Europe.
Europe, where upward mobility is now greater than ours. What the heck?
So yes, good point. So he's adopted that language. The question isn't whether that's language that conservative Republicans like and believe in. It is. The question is whether they believe him saying it. And Newt Gingrich is trying to go after that point by, in his ad, saying that Mitt Romney is timid. In other words, he might mouth the right words now because he's a shape-shifting politician, but he doesn't really believe it, especially if you look at his record in Massachusetts.
Jack, I though, listen to that and end up wondering, though, if he's framing the election up on a kind of lie. I mean, lots of people have gone after the federal government for going into bailout banks, but hey, where did that start? That crisis and that bailout started with the Bush administration. Detroit bailout, roots that go all the way back past Obama. I mean, what is this meme of Obama building a European-style social welfare state? Where is that, Jack?
Well, you know, it's hard to find the foundation of it, but it's far better ground for him to argue that proposition in the abstract than argue the particulars, which you just enumerated. For example, on Detroit, he wrote famously in November 2008, this is from the New York Times, "If General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler get their bailouts, you can kiss the American auto industry goodbye." Well, we just read yesterday that the big three, for the first time since 1988, had increased market share in the United States. Sounds like Mitt's business acumen wasn't on working that day. So you don't argue those facts. Instead, you go to the ideology and you say the president did these sorts of things because he has an appetite for it. You know, and at the time, President Obama said, "Look, I'm not doing this because I have an appetite for bailing out corporations, but to save these jobs, to save this industry." Don't argue the facts. Go right to the ideological plane. And I think it's cutting. Unlike Dana Milbank, I have a pretty strong regard for what I've seen of Mitt Romney on the trail. I watched him in Des Moines. I watched him in Council Bluffs over the weekend. Made very strong speeches. Got lots of response from the audience. And used lines like this. He said, "This election is a struggle for the soul of America." Well, asked what that meant, a woman said, "I don't think President Obama understands the soul of America." And then she said, "Because he wants everybody that has money to give it to other people that don't have money without working for it." Now, that's a clear argument against redistribution. Republicans don't like it. There's also a slight feeling in there, I won't say racial, or at least the other. Who's this other that's getting the money?
This European or this whatever other.
Yeah. And this business of soul of America, is there some view in there that somehow this exotic character, Obama, who represents, it seems to me, everything in meritocratic America in a way that Mr. Romney doesn't really. Can one really say he doesn't understand the soul of the country?
Yeah, Kim, I want to come to you for a little Wall Street Journal op-ed page view on that, but let me go to South Carolina, where it all rolls after New Hampshire first. Lee in Charleston. Lee, you're on the air.
Hello, hi, Com is great.
Hi, what's going on? What do you see?
Well, Obama came to us in 2008 speaking change, and America went for change, and unfortunately, change is what we got, but not what the change we wanted. And I think in 2012 is the year that is is do or die for America. I think the Republicans will come together. They will have a general consensus behind one candidate. A lot of folks now are not liking Newt Gingrich because he's a straight shooter. And I may not necessarily agree or disagree with all of his views. However, I can respect the man that will come to the microphone at the end of the day and, with speaking to the American people, speak what he feels is the right direction for our country and not just political rhetoric. And I think South Carolina will come to bat for Newt Gingrich, and he'll do far better than what his critics are saying he'll do.
You think he might still pull out here, win in South Carolina, and nose out in front of Romney, Lee?
Absolutely. Romney appears to be the president. He looks presidential. He talks presidential. But at the end of the day, looking and talking is two different things. And that's all we've had the last 4 years is talking. And I think Newt Gingrich is the guy we may very well elect as president. And I think he would certainly do the job.
Lee, I appreciate your call there from South Carolina, where it goes right after New Hampshire. Kim Strass will come back in on this Romney argument about here's a president wants to turn us into a European-style welfare state. Do you see evidence for that, Kim?
Well, you know, in the end, Tom, it doesn't really matter what the benighted press corps sees. I mean, it's what the American people see. And I don't think that there's any question that Mr. Romney is speaking to a vast number of people who do feel that. These are the people who came in 2010 and gave a Republican Congress its biggest victory in 60 or 70 years.
Are we smoking something here? Is it actually true, or are we just doing everything around smoke signals and puff?
No, look, if you are out there and you, I mean, let me give you a definition of a style of government. You've got a government dramatically increasing in its size and scope. You have a president who says he does.
Which it did under the Bush administration.
Yes, but nowhere near the amount of size and scope.
When you throw the wars in there, I don't know, but okay.
Okay, redistribution. You have a president who avowedly says that he believes in this. He does believe in taking money from some. You know, the wealthy are okay. We'll just take their money and we'll use it for priorities that I think are better.
Well, I take your point, but I mean, didn't things get redistributed dramatically up over the last couple of days? We've had a redistribution. It's all gone up in that little tiny top.
Well, actually, if you look at the share, then the overall amount of money that the top taxpayers pay as a portion of all taxes, that has gone up.
Well, sure.
So that's kind of the thing that I think. And that is all money you are taking away from job creators. You could argue that, you know, one of the reasons that we have such a problem right now is because job creators are overtaxed.
But they're not short on cash. I don't think you're going to say that.
Well, I do think that what they are short on is any certainty given the regulatory agenda of this current administration. You've also got a president who refuses in any way, shape, or form to reform entitlements, which are estimated to hit 11% of GDP by 2021. That is Europe all over. You've got one that a president.
Europe or Nixon or Eisenhower.
Obamacare, which is an increase of a new entitlement state and giving the government unprecedented new control over the healthcare industry. You got a president who believes firmly, strongly, and has done everything he can for unions. Again, another European trait. So I think a lot of Americans out there do see a lot of evidence for this. They didn't elect Barack Obama in 2008 to do these things, which is the most important point here. And there is a little bit of buyer's remorse, like the caller who just called in.
Yep. John in Amherst, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and thanks. I'm curious about your panel's assessment of Santorum. He's, of course, against the right to choose stock and trade for the GOP this year. He's also come out and said that the 65 Supreme Court decision legalizing birth control was a giant mistake, and he was today quoted on NPR in a clip of a speech where he remarked that he wanted to throw up when he read Kennedy's speech in 1960 separating his religious views from the state. Mm. Now, Santorum is a Catholic, a very strident Catholic. Maybe is he too strident in his religious views for the whole country, and certainly is there going to be a conflict between his strident Catholicism and, for instance, the Baptists or other evangelical Christians who are not Catholic among the GOP voters?
Yeah. What about Howard? Let me come to you on this one, because, you know, Rick Santorum, I thought, just for the feeling of authenticity and solidness of the man, when he hit the big TV screens all over with that Iowa showing, I thought he looked pretty sound. But when you look back at his record, he's got some what's the word our caller uses? Strident, to say the least, social views in there.
Well, as it happens, I've known Rick Santorum for more than 20 years, and we share a hometown, which is Pittsburgh, and, yeah. and I know about his background, and it didn't surprise me at all that he said that he threw up when he read John F. Kennedy's speech about the separation of church and state, because Rick Santorum says on the campaign trail, and I just heard him say it again in New Hampshire here the other night, that he views everything through the lens of faith. He calls his rallies faith and freedom rallies, and he basically argues that without faith and without a strict adherence to faith, democracy won't work. He makes the argument that we would have a lot less government, a lot fewer lawyers, a lot less spending, a lot less redistribution, you name it, if people were moral and self-reliant in a way that the founders envisioned, and then that can only be accomplished by strong faith.
I mean, faith is one thing, but it's the kind of faith.
Yes,
I mean, here we are in a time when people are sort of throwing their arms around a broader circle openly of Americans, gay Americans, and he's talking about man-dog sex.
I understand. I'm just trying to give you his worldview first.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay, that's his worldview.
Mm-hmm.
What he doesn't understand, I don't think, is that because he's such a pre-Vatican II Catholic, if you will, because he so sees everything through this lens, because he's utterly anti-abortion, because he does oppose the Baird versus Connecticut case that allowed, you know, saw a right to privacy and thus a right to contraception. Because of his views on gay marriage, which are very, 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 very strict and very, very combative, that people worry that his appeal to the use of faith in the interest of democracy is really would lead us in the direction of church-run policy. And that's what people in New Hampshire, I think, aren't necessarily going to like the more they hear about it. They do, voters, I went to an event where there were a bunch of undecided voters. They loved his talk about the culture of dependency and the sort of European stuff, the rifts that that Kimberly was talking about. But the more they read about his background, this is a state where of seculars, of independents, of live free or die libertarians, and I think in the end that's going to put a ceiling on how well he can do here. And I think it may hurt him in South Carolina for theological reasons.
Catholicism versus
Catholicism
Protestantism
versus Bible Belt Protestantism. I don't know, but ironically, the South Carolinians are going to be faced possibly with a decision between, you know, having to choose among a Mormon and two Catholics.
Let me get one call. Nashville, Tennessee. Jack, you're on the air. Just got a minute before the break, Jack.
Yeah, I would just want to say, Tom, that this idea that Obama is some raging socialist is just complete, utter nonsense. And it's intellectually dishonest for your guest to continue to spout this nonsense in the face of his actual behavior. And to say this as an ideological, what does that even mean? What are the facts? That's what I want to know. And there's no indication of it. And I'm not an Obama supporter, so please don't misconstrue my comments, but it is just a red herring.
And what about the this isn't exactly a counter-argument, but the counter-comment that, factual or not, it may resonate, Jack.
Well, of course it resonates, because if people hear the same propaganda over and over, that's how propaganda works. They begin to believe it, whether or not it's true.
Jack, in Nashville, nails it hard. Kim, we just got a few seconds before the break. What do you say in return?
I mean, I have never said that Barack Obama is a socialist. The argument was whether or not he is leading America toward a European style of government. And if he hasn't enacted policies that get you closer to that, I do believe a lot of Americans fear for that and think that that is true.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, an arrest and charges in the frightening spate of Los Angeles arsons. L.A. County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky sounded a little Churchillian or Gerald Fordian and very relieved.
Our long four-day nightmare is over. This has been literally a nightmare. I haven't had a good night's sleep since last week, and I'm looking forward to one tonight.
Ohio earthquakes blamed on fracking for natural gas or fracking's wastewater. Here's Columbia University seismologist John Amberster.
These earthquakes were sitting there waiting to happen. We have triggered these earthquakes.
And at the Rose Parade in Pasadena on Monday, behind the Palomino ponies and marching bands, Occupy protesters with a giant octopus representing corporate greed chanting, "Banks got bailed out, we got sold out." And there it is. Looking to weaken the news, a dead heat out of Iowa, new Pentagon strategy. Game on in New Hampshire for the GOP. Howard Fineman is with us. He's in Manchester, New Hampshire, where the spotlight turns. Well, it's turned already. Primary there next week. Kimberly Strassel is with us, a columnist, editorial board member at the Wall Street Journal, and Jack Beatty's here. Kim, I want to ask you about Ron Paul, because right there behind Romney and Santorum in Iowa, there was Ron Paul with that very striking, strong performance. I don't know where he goes, but what happens with Paul voters and Ron Paul in this chain of events?
Well, the one thing you know about Ron Paul and Ron Paul voters is so long as Ron Paul is in this race, those voters will be with him.
Yes, sir.
So
yes, ma'am.
This is another challenge for a guy like Santorum or a guy like Gingrich who are trying to unite voters around an alternative to Mr. Romney. Is that so long as Paul is in there, that's going to be a tough challenge because he's probably going to get a decent share of the vote in New Hampshire and on in South Carolina. His message does not resonate often broadly with across the whole spectrum of the conservative community, in particular his foreign policy views, and that puts a cap on his performance. But it is a high enough cap that he can continue to siphon away significant voters from other contenders.
Where does that swing things, Howard? Or does, I mean, everybody says he won't ultimately bolt the party and go third party because if nothing else, he's got his son Rand Paul who's there in the GOP. But it's such a big card floating around here, at least in the Iowa showing, Howard.
I don't think he'll make his decision based on his son.
Okay.
I really don't. I think it's a mixture of good news and bad news for the Republicans. The good news is that he won't bolt the party. The bad news is it'll come to Tampa with a whole bunch of delegates and try to make his views known there. If I can speak for a minute to the previous caller on the question of European versus American and the soul of America, and also on behalf of the benighted press corps, I think was the phrase.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, yes. As opposed to the in-touch editorial writers.
True.
A few things. First of all, the TARP bailout, the whole bailout of the banks was begun by those ultra-American Republicans during the 2008 presidency of George Bush, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, the whole idea of business regulation, the idea that business should be allowed to prosper but needs to be regulated by government, I think was put forward by a European named Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
The progressive tax system is something, whatever the numbers are, that has had bipartisan support, I think, for 70 or 80 years overall. And I don't think unions, I don't think it's fair, and I don't think I would want to say to any union member anywhere in America, certainly in any industrial union that I knew about growing up in Pittsburgh, that they were European. There was no more American institution that helped save capitalism and lead to a better distribution of wealth that supports democracy in America than the unions. So as the benighted reporter out here on the campaign trail, I felt I had to say all those things.
It is worth remembering. We are a nation of parts and have been for some time,
right.
And a lot of things that
exactly.
Can be portrayed as foreign, you can find it right there solid in our own history.
Yeah.
Mark,
tell one of the steelworkers in Pittsburgh that they're not American, okay?
Yeah, and then watch out. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I'd just like to extend a warm welcome to Kimberly Strassel, your visitor from a parallel universe.
Hey.
In my universe, the job numbers today showed 212,000 job gains in the private sector. That's the best performance in a long time. Under President Obama, over the past, since his stimulus bill took effect, over 3 million private sector jobs have been created. You got to contrast that to the performance under President Bush. During his 8 years in office, 673,000 private sector jobs were lost. By contrast, he added 1.7 million government jobs. President Obama has cut 600,000 federal jobs. The reality is that, and this bears on the election campaign that's going on today, because the Republican candidates all want to enact the same types of trickle-down economics that George Bush extended. Mitt Romney just announced a plan to cut taxes on millionaires. The average millionaire would save $150,000 in taxes, and he wants to increase taxes on those earning.
Mark, point's taken, Mark, but let me ask you this. It was Barack Obama himself who said, if we don't have a strong turnaround in 3 years, I'll be a one-term president. Now, you got a little better job report out today, but it's still 8.5% unemployment. That's not good.
Well, there has been a strong turnaround. It would be even stronger
Where?
If it were not for the fact that the Republicans have done everything they can to sabotage this. Someone once commented that they're trying, in order to drown the captain, they're sinking the ship. And that's what they've been doing for the past 3 years. The fact of the matter is that this economy is on a much, much better footing than it was when he inherited it.
Well, okay, we were in full crisis then. I'm sure he wished for a much better footing than it is right now when he took the job, no question. But points taken, Mark. Let me get one more right here. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Carolyn, you're on the air. Caroline.
Hi. I wanted to object to the notion that Republicans are job creators. I think they're job exporters, and they're outsourcing all the good-paying jobs and replacing them with service jobs, and a lot of people know that. I'm to the left of Obama. I'm very unhappy with him. I voted for him with great enthusiasm, and now I'm thinking of voting for Bernie Sanders, unless the Republicans nominate someone so horrifying I can't do it.
You're going to write in Bernie Sanders and pray. Okay, Caroline, I appreciate your call as well. I don't think we're going to solve that whole argument, but I think it's laid out well there, and that is seems to be, especially with the way the president's been speaking this week in his conference calls to Iowa and everything else he's laying out, it seems to be the argument we're going to have some big piece of it in the year ahead. Behind all that, cuts at the Pentagon this week, and the president right there talking about that. This was the president at the press conference next to Leon Panetta, defense secretary. New U.S. military strategy being rolled out that would cut something like $450 billion from the Pentagon budget over the next decade. Here's the president.
As we look beyond the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the end of long-term nation building with large military footprints, we'll be able to ensure our security with smaller conventional ground forces. We'll continue to get rid of outdated Cold War-era systems so that we can invest in the capabilities that we need for the future.
For the future. And at his side, Panetta acknowledging that the new military plan was driven in part by the government's fiscal situation. But there he was, insisting that the U.S. military would not be compromised in its ability to defend the country. Panetta.
In many ways, we are at a crisis point. But I believe that in every crisis, there is opportunity. Out of this crisis, we have the opportunity to end the old ways of doing business and to build a modern force for the 21st century that can win today's wars and successfully confront any enemy and respond to any threat and any challenge of the future.
Kim Strassel, do these look like reasonable and necessary Pentagon cuts, changes to you?
Well, as you heard from those clips, both Secretary and Panetta and President Obama were at great pains to suggest that this was simply a strategic shift. We would be even more prepared to deal with future threats, which is all a bunch of baloney. I mean, this is a gigantic drawdown of the military. It is being done for what John McCain rightly called a budget-driven defense strategy. It's taking a number and trying to hit it, cutting and slashing where you have to get to that point.
Does that make it fiscally responsible? Do we need it? I mean, we've got a pretty big budget hole.
Well, what you are talking about here is a 30%. When you add this number, the $350 billion in weapons programs that had already been killed, the potential $500 billion in sequestration that may come because of this failed budget discussions in Congress, you are looking at a 30% cut in the military by 2021. That is huge. It is being driven, by the way, and this is the point at which the rubber hits the road. We have been talking for years about this entitlement country, which is growing and growing and growing. And just to put this in perspective, in 2021, if these cuts all go ahead, the military will be getting about 2.7% of GDP in spending. The entitlement sector, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, will be getting 11%. And because there is no ability in Congress and no will by this president to cut entitlements, the only choice Americans are now facing is to cut their military and their defense.
Jack, maybe that's a cut we want to make. Or do we want to have more guns and less, I don't know, health care and pension for old ladies?
Well, you know, even with these cuts, Yeah, even with these cuts, not the last $500 billion that Kim posits. I mean, that's a potential if the sequestration goes through. But just with the cuts on order now, the president said we'll still be spending, what did he say, 10 times more than the next, is it 10 countries combined or something like that? Well, a lot of people might say, well, suppose we just spent 7 times more. Wouldn't we still be pretty strong? And there's a tough argument to make that we wouldn't be equally strong. And, you know, to me, the really crucial line in this defense statement that leaped out, I mean, first of all, two things. To see in Pentagon documents the wantonly wasteful cost, the cost of these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, 6,200 dead, 46,000 wounded. And the document goes on to say, yes, we'll be able to do limited counterinsurgency. And then in italics, here comes the historic sentence. However, U.S. forces will no longer be sized to conduct large-scale prolonged stability operations, meaning counterinsurgency is off the map. It's not what we're going to do anymore. No more nation building. No more of these involvements. This is sort of the doctrinal, if you will, equivalent of Secretary Gates's envoy to the country, where he said, you know, anybody that comes to a president and says, let's intervene again in the Middle East, had better have his head examined. So I think this strategy, this is a sadder but wiser Pentagon.
Howard Fineman, how do you look at it? I mean, on the one hand, Americans want to get, you know, back on a prosperity train, and we had a lot of global hegemony during a lot of prosperity years. On the other hand, here's Ron Paul saying, cut it out, bring it all home. And this budget heads more in that direction.
Yeah, it does. But I'm trying to look at things through the lens of the Republican primary race here now, and then on to the general election.
Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon's going to say this and did say this. Barack Obama is not going to campaign on this. I don't think it's going to be central to his campaign. I agree with Kimberly that the problem is entitlements. But as I listen to the Republican candidates on the campaign trail here, I hear them talking a lot about the problems of entitlements, about the problem of a dependency society. I heard Rick Santorum give a 15-minute explanation the other night of the problems with Social Security. But at the end of that long lecture that he gave, he didn't really spell out exactly what his plan was to really rein in and control the growth of entitlement spending. I hear the Republicans complaining a lot about it, but I don't really see maybe she at the editorial board there has seen all of their detailed plans for how they're really going to rein in entitlement spending. I don't see it from the candidates, and frankly, I don't really see it for the most part from Congress other than what Paul Ryan tried to do, and then he got shot down when he tried to do it.
Kim, is there a plan out there that you've seen? And
you would like? Is there one she likes?
That you like? And would it leave, you know, our inequities even worse?
No, I mean, Howard's right. I think that this has not been a leading issue for Republicans. They are complaining about it. I do think that it's worthwhile talking just about the remarkable shift, however, in the past 3 or 4 years, that everyone is talking about this to some degree or another, and that we even had a discussion this summer about the need to do something about this. This was considered the third rail of politics for decades and decades, and conservatives, in particular Paul Ryan, deserve a lot of credit for putting it front and center and making it a thing that even Democrats feel as though they need to address.
If they're all going to stand there and say Barack Obama and the Democrats are Europeans who want to create a dependency society like Europe, the Republicans have a responsibility to lay out a specific plan to get us from point A to point B. I think everybody agrees with their critique about runaway entitlements, but what the heck do you do about it? I haven't heard them say so.
I mean, if you look at the different candidates, for instance, Mitt Romney has embraced portions of the Paul Ryan plan. He's probably gone farther than most on the question, for instance, of Medicare in reform and having some sort of a premium support in that. Newt Gingrich has also done that. So there are candidates who have adopted this. The question, they're not necessarily leading with this, at least in the primary. We'll see where they go with it in the general election.
Hey, Jack, meanwhile, we've got these big bombings in Iraq this week. It looks like Sunni on Shiite bombings. I keep wondering if we'll work on entitlements. But meanwhile, are we going to have a little civil war sort of creeping out around the edges in Iraq while America goes to the polls in 2012?
Well, it certainly looks bad. Today's story about the Maliki government essentially embracing a Shiite militia that just weeks ago was killing Americans and saying, "Come on in, be part of the government, be part of our security apparatus." That kind of takes your breath away. These folks have all kinds of blood, American blood on their hands, and now they're going to be part of the government. Of course, the Sunni awakening was full of people who had American blood on their hands, and that didn't stop us paying them and essentially hiring them as our mercenaries. You know, I think the president, and it's clear, you read stories that say they will not go back. We will not go back in Iraq, no matter what happens. But it sure looks like a great opening there for Iran. This militia was very close to the Iranians and, in fact, got their weapons there.
And could be some incredible backdrop to a campaign season here, not to say awful for Iraqis in the middle of it right now. What a moment we're at. New Hampshire next week, then on to South Carolina, and everybody following. Kimberly Strassel at the Wall Street Journal, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Howard Fineman, editorial director of the AOL Huffington Post Media Group. See him all over NBC, MSNBC, Man of Parts. Howard Fineman, thank you for joining us.
I'm looking forward to seeing Jack bumping into Jack up here.
Okay. A little sumo wrestling in New Hampshire. That ought to be great. Jack Beatty, see you in the belly of the beast next week. We'll be in New Hampshire for the primaries. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.